So I can't help but kind of taking a retrospective and looking back on the life. And A Daybreak Handbook, the chapbook, is very directly linked to those early days. When Gail and I were first married, we were very young. We were only 21. And we had jobs in the garden center and greenhouse industries. And that's kind of what we thought we were going to do for our careers. I was gearing up for a career in landscape architecture, either that or fisheries biology, and I was having a really hard time deciding. But I took a creative writing class at the local community college, and it lit a fire that I'd had secretly all my life. I had wanted to be a writer since I was very small. In fact, my mother tells a story of coming in the house when I was in second grade, because in third grade, in those days, we learned cursive. And I knew about cursive because I was looking ahead at the older kids. And I was sitting at the counter with a stack of papers, and I was scribbling on them. I was pretending to write cursive, and she said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm writing a book." And I don't remember that moment, but I remember that feeling that there was magic in books. So it was always in the back of my mind. The creative writing class, though, really, really lit something in my heart, but not enough that I was able to admit to my wife, even, that I wanted to be a writer until we'd been married a year. And at the end of the year, we decided we needed to have some adventures. So we quit our jobs, and we sold everything, and we bought an old Ford van, and we converted it into a camper. My parents would say a hippie van, but it was a camper. And we set off across the country, and we lived in the van for 6 months, and we drove from coast to coast and had a lot of adventures. Well, about halfway through that trip, we were going through the panhandle of Idaho. And I said, "Gail, I gotta tell you something." And she says, "Okay, what?" And I said, "I want to be a writer. And I want to make it my career. I don't want it to be a hobby. I want to write full-time for the rest of my life." And she was a little surprised, and she didn't know anything about what was involved. But she said, and we laugh about this to this day, she said, "Just promise me one thing." And I said, "Yes, anything." She said, "Don't be a poet." And when we laugh about it with our friends who are poets, and they're always a little alarmed, but we realize that what she had in mind were the beat poets and the poets we saw in San Francisco who were hawking their mimeographed broadsides on the street for a quarter or a dollar each. So it was always sort of a standing joke. But the fact was that I always wrote poetry. In fact, I started writing poetry and fiction. And when I went back to school after that great trip, when we got our plans made, we came back to Michigan, and I got back in school and got a degree in English and studied poetry and fiction. Because at that point, I never really conceived of writing anything but poetry and fiction, because that's what I love to read. And it wasn't until after college, the first year or so after college, that I had an opportunity to write nonfiction for a magazine. I was invited to write an essay about a river. And I did, and it was great fun. It was so fun that I just never looked back, and I just ran with it after that. But I always have written poetry. And usually it's a warm-up in the mornings, how I can get the language center of my brain working a little bit and firing. And often what I write in those moments goes on to become something bigger, a chapter in a book many times, or an essay. But on the side, I have been writing these little prose poems. And finally, there came a point last year about this time when I realized that I was starting to get enough for a small collection. And I was aware of a fine small press here in Ann Arbor called Alice Green and Company. And I have friends who had published with them, and I just dropped them a note one day and said, "Would you be interested in seeing a collection?" And they were, and I'm very fortunate that they liked it, and I'm also very fortunate that they're here tonight. Jill Peek and Colin O'Brien of Alice Green and Company took this little project and ran with it, and it's been really fun. So I'd like to read a couple of the little pieces. It's broken into two parts, the first about childhood and the second is more recent. This is called Dredge. Deep in the yard of the house where I grew up, are my artifacts. Fish hooks and rusty nails. The pocket knife my father gave me when I was 9 that somebody stole. A baseball I lost in the woods in 1964 when the sweet spot of my bat met the sweet spot of the ball and it soared away, a glorious parabola, like the arc of years, to the trees and gone. My brother's stamp collection, plastic soldiers and plastic guns, arrowheads, bullets, and cherry bombs, test tubes and a Bunsen burner, antler nubs of the deer I shot when I was 14, baseball cards in a Band-Aid box packed with wheat pennies, beach glass, a photo of my dog swimming for a stick, letters to my future self warning against the perils of girls and growing old. Beneath it all, a stratum of clean sand, then a stratum of ice, then bedrock. It's a relief when you get beneath the layer where you lived. We grew up gritty. Our knees and elbows were skinned, and we had scabs on our chins from the planet spinning so hard against us. In summer, our world was water, wood, and stone, sand, mud that sucked the shoes off our feet. The woods were our sanctuary, their canopy a vaulted roof shielding us from the sky. We ran barefoot through trilliums and poison ivy. A kid jumped into shallow water off the dock at the dairy bar, and a knife he was carrying in his shirt pocket pierced his heart, and he died. What was this war going on around us? Every day it was sunshine or deadly lightning strikes. Maybe we could have taken our questions to the old folks, but they were always busy. Instead, we played 27-inning baseball games and argued over who got to be alkaline. Then we ran for our bikes and raced to the lake, swam to the neighbor's raft and dove off and stroked to the bottom and climbed back on the raft with our hands full of muck to prove it and dove again and again until we were exhausted. Later, we stretched out on our back in the woods pondering the mystery of no two trees alike while our dogs lay with their heads on our laps watching us expectantly. In a plastic bag in a hollow stump was a Playboy Dell had stolen from his father's closet. Miss July planned to go to college and solve the cancer problem. It was confusing to try to examine her primly concealed pudendum. Some days I rode my father's rowboat through the channel to Mickey Lake and rowed around the perimeter of the lake as fast as I could, dragging a rope in the water. I rowed for hours until my palms flared and blistered. Dad thought I was burning excess pubescent energy, but I was in rescue mode, searching for anyone who might grab the rope. I figured I could sort out later who was the rescuer and who was the rescued. When I started out, and I'm still in the retrospective mood, when I started out making my living as a writer in the late 80s, I found journalism to be the entry for me. It felt a long ways away from fiction and poetry, but that seemed to be where the opportunities lay in those days. And it was only gradually that I started realizing that it was in journalism about the environment and about the natural world that my future lay. And I started writing more personal pieces about my connection with the lands and waters of the planet, but particularly Northern Michigan, where I grew up. That was really what I wanted to do mostly. Not always easy to break in that world, of course, and I was a little shy about it. I felt uncomfortable writing about myself, first of all, especially after working in journalism for a few years. And it was a couple of friends who encouraged me to try that. And one of them was the artist Glenn Wolfe. Now, Glenn and Gail and I went to high school together. We were only a year apart in high school, but Glenn and I didn't know each other. And it was only after he had moved to New York and was making a name for himself as an artist that he and I became acquainted. We found our work showing up in some of the same publications. He illustrated a lot for the New York Times. He did and still does work for the Science Times and for their sports section. And they're beautiful. Anybody who reads the Times, if I showed you his work from the Times, you'd recognize him immediately. It's very distinctive, beautiful, large-scale, stippled ink illustrations that are magnificent. And he he kept urging me to write more about my experiences growing up and other and not so old experiences, recent experiences as well. And without my real knowledge of it, he told an editor at the Times about my work, and she asked to see it. And it kind of it led to a really great relationship and a long-standing one, and gave me a chance to write for a big audience about Michigan, which was really fun because really it was the cliche is true. They have no idea there what we have, and it was like going to a really welcoming country as an emissary and saying, oh, let me show you slides of my vacations and stuff, because they really wanted to know about them. It was great fun. But the first piece that I did for them was the toughest, of course. It always is. You've got to get your foot in the door, of course, and break in and show them what you can do. So I had this invitation, send a piece in, and we'll see what happens. And so I did the piece, and it was about when I was in college at Northern in Marquette, hitchhiking across the UP to the Fox River near Sini, and retracing Nick Adams' journey in Big Two-Hearted River, because many of you already know that this story was not about the Two-Hearted River, it was about the Fox River, but Hemingway told his father in a letter that he changed the name because Two-Hearted is poetry. A lot of us think he did it also to disguise a really good fishing river. So I went just on my own just to see if I could retrace the route that Nick had taken after he got off the train in Sini. And it was a fiasco. It fell all apart. I had a great adventure getting there, and everything looked great. But once I got to the river, and I'm walking through the weeds, this was in July, and it had been raining for days, and clouds of mosquitoes came out of the weeds, and it's unlike anything I've ever seen. And I've spent a lot of time in Canada in places where there's a lot of mosquitoes. It was different. This was spooky. There were so many of them. I would take my repellent and spray it into them, and it didn't matter because there were so many. They were being pushed into me against by the crowd and back. And I just finally ended up running for the highway and stuck my thumb out and hitchhiked back to Marquette. So that was the essay I wanted to write for the Times. And the editor, Susan Adams, faxed me and said, I hope everyone knows what a fax machine is, and said, I want to talk about this essay. I'm going to call you tomorrow morning at 10 a.m. So Gail's heard this story. And our son Nick was 3 years old. And Gail and I, in our work life in those days, was we split up child duties by the every day. I'd be with the kids in the morning or the afternoon. She'd be working. She had her graphic design business was going pretty well then, and by then, and then we would trade duties. Well, it happened to be my day to work to be with the kids in the morning, so Nick is there, and I'm expecting this call. And a few minutes before 10, I had a bathroom emergency, and because I was nervous. And Nick loved to talk on the phone. He loved to talk on the phone. He just would run to it every time. He'd race us to it. And I said, Nick, don't answer the phone if it rings. Don't answer. And he goes, okay. He was playing with Legos or something. And so I went to the bathroom. And, of course, when I was in the bathroom, the phone, I could hear the phone ring. And I yelled, don't answer the phone. But then I heard his pattering feet go to the phone. He picks it up. He goes, hello? And there's a pause. And he goes, no, he can't. He's pooping. And so I called her back, and a few minutes later, and she was still laughing. And years later, she told me, she said, you know, even if your essay had been crappy, I would have been really inclined to accept it because that was so delightful. It was so funny. So she became a good friend. So it sort of set a pattern, you know, write about the things you care about and write about adventures and set out and, you know, as the great Bill Bryson has taught everyone who's read his books, the best way to write about your adventures is when you are the klutz, when you are the fool. I'll never match him for klutzhood, but I've come kind of close. Lots of things have gone wrong, and the Living Great Lakes is a really good example of that. I set out with all seriousness and remained serious all the way through that book to tell the story of the Great Lakes, to alert these people on the East and West Coast that we have an amazing natural resource here, a natural treasure. a world-class treasure, in that they deserve, the lakes deserve to be understood and respected and protected. But along the way, things happened, and they kept happening, from getting seasick after talking my way very skillfully onto a sailboat in the Chicago to Mackinac race, to nearly getting run over by a freighter in the St. Clair River, and onward and onward. So that sort of happens, and I don't know why it happens to some of us more than others, but it always seems to. A couple years ago, I spent a year living in houses around the Great Lakes, getting to know areas of the lakes better that I had always wanted to go back to, and had a lot of great adventures as well in doing that. And one of the books that came out of that is The Windward Shores, and it's about winter on the lakes. And I decided to take the places that we stayed, I stayed alone, or Gail and I, and in some cases our kids as well, stayed in these places and got to know the areas a little bit, and was able to write about that place, and then also more about the Great Lakes and their significance, and about our place in nature. And since it's winter, and since our friends and family on the East Coast are getting hammered tonight, I thought I would read a little from that, with the cold and the ice, especially on our minds. And this is set in February. This was a winter that wasn't as severe as last winter, but it was one of the good ones. It was one where we had a lot of ice build up along the shores and a lot of really cold days. And so this chapter is about a place called Pine Hollow, which is a house that will be described a little bit as I read. February stayed cold every day. In the mornings, I doubted the day could be as cold as the one before, so I put on my insulated boots and goose down coat and wool hat and mittens and stepped outside to see what progress the ice had made. And every morning, I discovered again how cold it was. That month, Gail and I lived in a house built to last 1,000 years, or so the owner said, and we believed her. The house called Pine Hollow was built in the woods above the shore of northern Lake Michigan on a foundation of boulders and glacier-scored flagstones supported by tree trunks for pillars and massive oak beams and capped with a copper roof, enduring materials of bedrock density harvested mostly from nearby. Here was mass and gravity stacked against time. There were 12 bedrooms and 15 bathrooms. That's just a guess. I kept losing count. By the time you walked from one end of the house to the other, then up the stairs and back across the second floor, then up to the third floor lofts with their additional bedrooms and baths, and then climbed the circular stairs to the solitary stone turret that rose above the third floor, you too would have lost track of where you'd been and how many rooms you had visited. You would have been distracted along the way by the library with its sliding ladder and leather chairs, and by the main hall with its vast fireplace fed by upright logs the length of fence posts, and by the movie screening room with its reclining theater chairs, and by the wine cellar below the kitchen, and by the living room and its Steinway, and especially perhaps by the Olympic-sized indoor swimming pool with its polished steel footbridge arching over the water and the waterfall gurgling beneath, and probably by the two bars, well-stocked and cheery with clinking ice machines. Too much, the first-time visitor exclaims, and soon after, I'm not leaving until the police drag me away. One bathroom was decorated in white Italian marble, floor, walls, shower, and countertops, even ceiling. Another was finished in polished black granite with a faucet that activated a pool of water on the back of the countertop to silently rise until it overflowed as a gurgling stream rushed down a trough and became a waterfall cascading into the sink. This could get out of hand. The bath in the master bedroom in the second floor suite where Gail and I stayed contained a shower large enough for a basketball team. Next to it was a stainless steel whirlpool bath shaped like an enormous cream pitcher. All the bathrooms had heated floors. Also, their towel bars were heated, a luxury I wasn't aware existed. Each bedroom was named for one of the world's great lakes. We slept in the Lake Malawi room. It was the master bedroom of our suite, which included also the Lake Michigan and Lake Huron rooms, as well as a living room and a kitchenette. I worked in the Lake Baikal room, a studio with a fireplace and an oak desk at a window overlooking Lake Michigan. Secret passages connected the children's rooms. Nobody else was in the house, by the way. We had it to ourselves, so There was danger of getting lost. We carried beepers. One was accessed through a small port with an oval door just large enough to squeeze through. It connected a small bedroom designed like the stateroom in a sailboat to the loft of a larger bedroom with ceiling fans shaped like mechanical butterflies. Another led to a hidden loft containing a small library with its walls lined with classic and contemporary children's books around a child-scale table and chairs. Another led to a ladder that descended to the hallway adjacent to the pool. These were all secret tunnels. I spent much of every day in the main library, working at a sturdy wooden table with the fireplace at my back. Around the walls, the bookshelves reached to the ceiling, the upper shelves made accessible by a wheeled ladder of the sort familiar to readers of Victorian novels. There was a section of bookshelves filled with such novels, and other sections for contemporary novels, and poetry, and biographies, and nature books, and science, philosophy, and theology. Next to the fireplace was a staircase leading to a loft where the art books were. But you get the idea. Quality and beauty built to last. Would it last 1,000 years? It seemed possible. We settled in and soon felt quite at home. Every night the ice grew a few feet farther into the lake. Waves washed over it and receded and left accruing layers of ice that grew into miniature mountains and volcanoes. As the ice proceeded, it left those structures behind in a broad Arctic landscape of slabs and ice hills and drifted snow. Most days remained overcast, but when the sun came out, it was transformative. The fresh snow glared a blinding white. Plates of ice, tilted and jumbled like sections of broken sidewalk, glowed with a penetrating blue light as if lit from within. The open water steamed. Approaching as near as I dared, I watched sluggish waves rise from the lake and heave against the ice, drum gulping in secret hollows beneath. A moment after every wave, cone-shaped blowholes 6 or 8 feet high expelled fountains of spray into the air. They wheezed like exhaling whales. The wind stunned my face until my eyebrows ached and my white breath streamed behind. It surprised me to realize that the water in the lake, so cold that it could kill a person in 5 minutes, was the warmest element here. I bent and examined the forward edge of the ice. It was white with trapped air and appeared molten, like candle wax after it has liquefied and congealed. It was a polished, milk-colored jumble, smoothed by waves' slap. Balls of ice as small as marbles and as large as baseballs had been tossed by the waves and were cemented to every surface. So you can see that it was that juxtaposition of culture and all of the amazing things that we have done, and sometimes the excessive things we have done with the lakes themselves and what was going on in the winter that created the impetus and the tension in the book that really made me want to write this. I had been wanting to write a book about winter on the Great Lakes since I was in college. Excuse me a sec. Elk Rapids. Yeah. She tried to. I mean, I don't remember, $20 million to build it. And she could afford it. But she had gotten to the point where she was ready to get rid of it. She tried to donate it to the University of Michigan, and they didn't want it because it's so expensive to keep it up. And so it's used now for gatherings of people, you know, that want to have a retreat and brainstorm and do things. So I don't even really know. Gail, do you know what they're using it for more now? It's a nonprofit or now, yeah. 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 Yes. Leslie Lee is the owner, and she just published a book of photographs and essays about the house. Yeah, it's a beautiful house, and you know, amazing workmanship. She literally hired every stonemason in the northern half of Michigan, as far away as Clare, and all the way up to the UP. Any stonemason who could cut it, who was good enough, was working on that job, to the point where many of them had to leave because it was, you know, taken so long. It was years putting this together. The stonework is incredible. And all the beams and posts are white oak from northern Michigan. And yeah, it's amazing. Gail and I want. We had a little log cabin in the woods still, but it was pretty interesting. Yeah. Well, that would be the kind of place you could do. I mean, really, we had a lot of friends come in to visit while we were there. We were there a month, and everybody had lots of ideas for some reason, sitting around the fireplaces. And it is kind of fun to say, well, which fireplace do you feel like using tonight? So once in a lifetime. Well, we have started a small press, and this is a very exciting project for us. Gail's graphic design business included working on books right from the beginning, from 1986. I mean, right? Nick was born in 86. You dropped off a job at the FedEx box on the way to the hospital to deliver him. I remember that. And books, of course, were such a passion, always have been for us, that we always dreamed of working together to publish books, to create books. I mean, just to make something new in the world and to put everything we know into it. So this past year, we had the opportunity. Gail ended her 16 years of working for a nonprofit conservation organization in Traverse City, and she said, I'm ready for a new challenge. I said, let's do it. Let's go to work. And so she's the creative director of Big Maple Press. Glenn Wolf, the artist, is a partner, and I'm a partner. And what we've decided to do first was, or what we did decide to do first, was to bring out our two early books that Glenn and I did together. It's Raining Frogs and Fishes, about wonders of the sky, and The Bird and Waterfall, about wonders of water. They were both published in the 90s, and they did well. It's Raining Frogs and Fishes made it as high as number 13 on national bestseller lists. Never cracked the top 10 in the New York Times. Was translated into a bunch of languages, had a really nice run, but eventually it went out of print. Both of them went out of print, and we were able to get the rights back to these books. And so we've been kind of deciding what to do with them for a couple years. We turned down some offers from other presses to bring them out because we kind of had in the back of our mind that we could do it ourselves and really have fun doing it. So that's what, this is The Bird and Waterfall, and It's Raining Frogs and Fishes is its companion. So we set out to resuscitate and revive and update these books and just had an immense amount of fun doing it. It's a great, great project for us, and it brings together all the things that we really care about books and gives us a chance to do it ourselves. And we'll do at least one more book this year, and they'll be out in the summer. I'll read just a little bit about this to give you a feel for what kind of books they are. It's something that, as a young student, I was fascinated with biology and with the natural sciences, and I really did want to be a fisheries biologist. But I didn't have an inspiring teacher in high school or college. I had inspiring teachers in English and in creative writing. But biology and botany and all the natural sciences that I took, I just wasn't lucky enough to have that teacher who knew how to really light a fire in me, at least, maybe some other students. And one of the problems I had was that the books were so boring. Here's these subjects that I cared so much about, and then you just get slogging through this prose that's dead, and there's just no effort to make it fun to read. So I started, as a journalist, one of the things I did was write about science, and wrote about science for lots of publications, from Smithsonian to Audubon, and I loved that. And I loved taking a kind of complex idea and making it fun to read about. And so that was the goal with these books. And, of course, about subjects I care about. And water. Water has been there all along. This is from the chapter on meandering rivers, which set out to answer the question, why do rivers meander? And it turns out to be a lot more complex than I ever imagined. And it led me down some interesting pathways to laboratory work with chaos theory and laminar flow and amazing stuff going on that I had no idea about. And I got to see scientists at work running water down an inclined plane of sand. and they would study, they would film it, and they would study the way the water would start. It would always go start straight, and then it would start to bend, and then it would bend back the other way, and then it would go more and more dramatically into meanders. And it was fascinating, and then they would try to do, show me how it works mathematically, and they would lose me. Our language makers must have lived near rivers. We think in streams of consciousness and speak in sweeping channels of utterance. If we speak well, we're told we are fluent, and no one is surprised to learn that the word is derived from the Latin to flow and shares roots with fluid and flux and effluence. Listen carefully to flowing water and you can hear babbling, murmuring, and whispering sounds so like human voices that you wonder if rivers were the primal models for the sounds we make. In writing, we shape our thoughts into sentences and string them together until they look like a river meandering across a plain. The words line back and forth down the page, slowing at commas, eddying between parentheses, gathering force and momentum until they spill off the bottom of the page like water falling off a continent into an ocean. In an Inuit legend, all rivers once flowed both uphill and down, but Raven, the creator of the world, decided that such a convenient arrangement made life too easy for people. We have been riding the current or fighting it ever since. Those who ride it are river people. River people know that current can be resisted, but never defeated. They abandon themselves to flow and flux, accept the value of boundaries and the power of persistent current, understand that loved ones, accomplishments, opinions, possessions, and all the carefully fashioned handiwork of a lifetime fall eventually to the surface and are carried away downstream. If you are a river person, you can never cross a bridge without looking for a glimpse of water. You remember your first river trip in a canoe or kayak and the intoxicating sensation that you were getting something for nothing, stealing a free ride, a gratis trip on the merry-go-round. You remember the dizzying conviction that you and the river were stationary while the land unreeled beside you in a continuous play of background and perspective. Rivers enchant us and somehow pry into the nebulous pleasure centers in our brains. I think it is a matter, largely, of earning the right to be enchanted. We care most deeply about rivers when we have invested a great deal of effort in working on them or have spent much time boating, fishing, exploring, or observing them. As in any love affair, you get back only as much as you put in. It's a tribute to the value we place on moving water that so many people are willing to put so much into the affair. Well, thank you. We have time for questions if anybody has anything they want to talk about or questions they want to address.
Hi, Jerry. Joe Neely is my name. If I were a little better looking, I think that we might have been separated at birth as twins, because I'm also just turned 60, a child of the Great Lakes and a writer, too. I grew up on the Great Lakes in Grand Haven, and that was a time when the middle class was still on the lake. I was middle class. My friends were middle class, and we just had, you know, every summer was magic, and wonder if you agree with me and all that the middle class is being shut out of the lake. Certainly it is, and the lower, anything other than the wealthy. You know, the great old cottages from the cottage next door to, my sister has our old house now, which is the only way we could afford it. But the beautiful 1927 cottage next door to us was purchased, torn down the next day, and monstrosity put up. Are you seeing that a lot? Do you think that's a danger? I think it's a terrible danger.
Yeah, I think it's a reflection of some of the things that have happened to the lakes. I know exactly what you mean. I was struck while traveling through the lakes on boats that, you know, around harbor mouths, you'd see small boats fishing. But once you get out of reach of the safe ports, the only boats you would ever see were giant yachts. Big, I mean, besides commercial ore carriers and freighters, but the only recreational boats were big, and even the small boats. I mean, there just weren't that many small boats. Period. And I think it's changed. Part of the change has been in the fishery. When we were growing up, one of the great fisheries. Well, of course, we were there when the salmon came, and before that, when the lakes were in real serious trouble. But even when the alewives were the dominant fish, when they were 90% of the biomass in all the lakes in the 50s and early 60s, There was still a good population of perch, and there was smelt, and the smelt runs were fantastic. And that was ways that people who couldn't afford a big boat for the open lake could participate in the lakes. They could go out in their small boats and fish for perch. In Lake Erie, they go out and fish for blue pike, which are now extinct in the Great Lakes. They're a relative of the walleye that were incredibly abundant and could be caught real easily by families. You go down around Toledo and all along the western basin, the lake, on Friday nights, whole families would go out in their little boats, their little 12-foot params, go just, 100 yards offshore, drop their lines, and catch a really nice mess of sauger and perch, or blue walleye and perch. And that's gone. Now, to catch fish consistently in the Great Lakes, you have to go into the big lake, into deep water, with very high-tech equipment that's very expensive. And you see that a lot. I don't know. The places where I do see a lot of middle-class involvement is around places like Indiana Dunes, where the beaches are still really popular and are easy to get to, and people from Chicago and its suburbs all the way around the southern end of the lake in Indiana go there on the weekends to swim and play in the beach. And that's encouraging. It's good to see that. That hasn't changed much, I don't think, in our lifetime. But the lakes, I think all the changes in the lakes have affected us in many ways. The property values, of course, have it made it impossible for most of us to afford a waterfront house. Although I was talking to my dad about that recently, and he said, well, don't forget, in 1963, when we were looking for a new house, we couldn't afford one on the Great Lakes either. And that was at a time when nobody really wanted to live on lakes because the die-offs of alewives were so obnoxious. You could smell the lakes from a half mile away. So maybe in some ways that hasn't changed as much. It'd be interesting to see proportionately compared to the rest of the economy how much those values have gone up. But I do know what you mean. Yeah. One question. Go ahead.
Hi, Martha. I wondered if you could speak about your transition from journalism to writing your own work, kind of how you navigated that. You said at the beginning that it was kind of a transition that made you nervous, remembering what you said correctly, and I was curious to how you decided to go from journalism into nonfiction, because you'd also considered fiction and poetry, so mm-hmm. if you could just speak to that a little bit.
Well, are you a writer?
I am. I was a reporter for a couple of years, and now I'm back in school studying some librarianship. And I want to keep writing, but I struggled a little bit with. I enjoyed reporting, but I felt like it drew me away from writing what I wanted to write.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've always, I work with aspiring writers a fair amount, and I always encourage them to write what they like to read. And for me, when I would go to a magazine, I would always turn to the back page first, to the meditative piece at the end, the think piece that the editors would always call it. And the piece where it was how it was written was as important as what was written. It wasn't just information. It wasn't just facts. That's what excited me as a reader. And so it was really natural that's what I wanted to write. And at first, because I was, I think by nature, shy and was figuring it out as I went, and because I wanted to make a living as a writer and was determined to, journalism was easier. It was, the doors opened right up. And, you can write about a subject where you research and where you interview people and you kind of follow the journalistic formula. It was definitely easier, and it didn't need 10 drafts, it needed 3. And at a point when, in those years, I was writing 50 magazine pieces a year and a book, and I was working, I was really working at it. But at some point, kind of soon into it, like after 3 years, I'd look back on that year's output, those 50 magazine pieces, and there would only be 2 or 3 that I was proud of. And I went, is this what I want to do? So that's anyway, I'm just telling you why I decided to go that way, because that's where my interest was, and that's what I really would love to read. So I just shifted gears, and I just started turning down the, you know, as many of the journalistic opportunities or assignments as I could afford to, and giving my attention instead to writing from my own experience, and trying to write evocatively, trying to give a reader the experience that I had had or that I wanted to convey. And I found that there was a market for it, and it's different now. In those days, there were hundreds and hundreds of magazines that are now gone, and every one of them was hungry for good writing. They weren't necessarily looking for what I wanted. You know, I had to select the magazines carefully. I had to become a student of magazines, and I really worked at that, read every magazine I could get my hands on. Everywhere we went, I would go to bookstores, to the newsstands, and look for magazines and buy them and take them and study them, you know, and that became part of the job. But I would identify the magazines that I wanted to write for, and then I would just keep after, and I would send them work over and over. And one of the things that I liked about it was that in journalism, you write a proposal. You write just as you would in a nonfiction book. You write a proposal to the editor suggesting that you would like to write an article on such and such. And then you tell them a little how you would do it, and then you give your you know, qualifications for writing it. And then you try to get an assignment. Now, the good thing about that is that once you have an assignment, then, you know, 99% of the time probably it's going to get published, because they've committed to it, and they'll work with you. If it isn't quite right, they'll work with you. But that wasn't really what I was excited about. What I was excited about was writing the way I wanted to, about what I wanted to, and then sending the finished piece, just sending it over the transom. And that's kind of fun. Then you get that, you know, you can wait for the mail to come and or the email, and you can get an acceptance letter sometimes, and that's really exciting. So it just sort of evolved into that, and I just got to the point where that became my goal. And I was able to eventually get to where that's all I did. I wrote those pieces. So instead of writing 50 pieces a year, I was writing 12 and a book. And many of those pieces became part of the book, you know. So it was a matter of targeting it, I guess, is the short answer.
What was your first book? How long did it take you to write it? And how long did it take to get published?
Oh, Canoeing in Michigan Rivers. 2 years to write it. It came out, Craig Day, my old college buddy, and I came up with the idea. We loved to canoe and fish and camp, and we discovered that nobody had ever done a guidebook to Michigan rivers. And practically every other state that we checked into or traveled to had them. Michigan didn't, and here we have all these amazing rivers. So, let's do it. So we learned how to, and we were green. We were kids. And we learned how to write a book proposal by going to the library, and we wrote a proposal, and we described ourselves as an author-photographer team, freelance author-photographer team, who at that point, I think I had published 2 articles in a local magazine in Traverse City, and Craig and I both were just out of college. And Craig had not only never been a photographer, he had never owned a camera. And we sent the proposal to, I don't remember, 6 or 8 Michigan-based publishers, including the University of Michigan Press, and now I've done a book with them so I can tease them about this, and we got a bunch of rejections. But we got one letter back from a small press in Davison, Michigan, called Freed Publications, and we had noticed that they only published books about Michigan. And we got a letter back, and I can remember to this day how exciting that was. Dear Mr. Date and Mr. Dennis, our entire staff is very excited about your proposal. We would love to do a book with you. And God, you know, we just went berserk. So it took 2 years then to canoe all these rivers and 1,500 miles of rivers and write descriptions of them and do maps. And Craig did the photography. He became a damn good photographer, in fact. And finally, we get a chance to meet the publisher. And he was a great guy named Gary Barfnecht. And we, you know, met him. He had a limousine pick us up, and we all went out to dinner. It was just great. It was so fun. And when we got along, I said, well, Gary, we have a confession to make. When we sent that proposal, we were not a freelance photographer team. We had never, and writer team, we had never publish anything together. Craig had never had a camera. And he laughed. Then he goes, well, I have a confession to make, too. And I said our entire staff was excited. Our staff was me. So we became friends for life and still are friends. He's a great, great guy. So 2 years. And on average, that's what it takes to write a book. The Living Great Lakes took 5. But most of them have been two or three. So that's the last time I ever lied.
After you finish writing it, then how long before it's actually published?
6 months.
Another 6 months.
Yeah, about that. You know, I have to come back and forth a few times for corrections and stuff. So I've had a book take a year. It just depends on the publisher. These days, it's a lot faster. Things are real quick. When we own the press, it's real fast. Yeah. 12. I published 12 and got my 13th ready to go, so almost ready to go. So it's about one every two and a half years, so almost 30 years I've been doing this. So Maureen.
I have two different questions. One is, who are your favorite authors? Who are you reading this year? Or who are you looking forward to their next book? And what are your favorite magazines?
I read widely. I still go to novels first. I love fiction, and I've been a student of it all my life. And there are authors I revisit pretty regularly. I still love the modernists and. You know, from Joyce to Virginia Woolf and all of the great American modernists. These days, when I want to read nonfiction, I go to people like Joan Didion again and again and again. I just read her Year of Magical Thinking that is devastating and beautiful and somehow hopeful in the midst of all her tragedy. And I am always on the lookout for promising new writers and stuff. So I feel like it's a writer's duty to read way beyond their field of interest, way beyond. And so I'm constantly challenging myself to do that. And I'm lucky to have friends who are great writers, many of them who teach writing and literature, or who are great readers, I mean. And they can keep me informed. Hey, you got to read this person. And so we do that. Magazines I've kind of become disenchanted with. I think it's a little bit of overload for me because I worked for them for so long. I can see all the tricks now, and you know, I know it's coming way too often. So I don't read magazines as much as I used to. But every once in a while, I'll pick up the New Yorker or I subscribe to Harper's, but I don't read them with the passion that I used to. Books. I read Orion, and I read Krakauer, but yeah, I think it's gotten to be, you know, when I read writers who are too much like me, that's not fun anymore. No, I don't. That just doesn't do it for me. I want new voices. I want fresh voices. So I'm always trolling through literary journals looking for writers who are new to me, and I just always looking for stuff. I love writing for the literary journals, you know. I've got a piece in Mid-American Review right now. I had a piece in Michigan Quarterly Review in the summer that was really fun to write. And it's great fun to, I've made friends with authors who are in the same issues, you know. So you're not making money, and you have a readership of 1,500 people. It's really fun to get a letter, so we write letters to each other. Loved your piece.
Last question, I promise. Has your advice changed to as to how aspiring writers should go about getting published? Are you more inclined to the old model, you know, get an agent, the query letters, and all that sort of thing? With the technology of being able to print more on your own, have you given any thought to you know, how people should, how people might get published if the old model is not working for them?
Yeah, I've given that a lot of thought, and I've studied it, and I've tried to figure out what I would do if I were just starting out right now. And I have to say it'd be tougher, I think, than it was. I was able to follow the kind of traditional trajectory where I started by writing locally and with magazines in northern Michigan, then expanded to Michigan, then the Midwest, and then went national. Then I was able to attract the attention of the New York Times. I mean, when you get your byline in the New York Times, good things happen. And I was able to get an agent and had publishers interested. And so, you know, it was just a real conventional trajectory for me. Now I don't know what to do because I don't know what to tell young writers to do because the opportunities are not the same, at least. Now, there are a lot of opportunities still. I think if I were a young writer with any talent for fiction, I'd be writing young adult novels right now because you read Publishers Weekly and they have the deals section of Publishers Weekly. Every week they list the big deals that were completed that week, one after another after another. I mean, 90% of them are young adult series, and they're for a lot of money. And it's, you know, that seems to be the publishing industry. They just released a report last year that overall the industry was up. Books are selling again, and the adult nonfiction category, mine, was up, you know, a resounding 3%. Young adult fiction, 23%, you know, it was a big year, and it's been one year after another like that. So I don't know. I would also, and I encourage writers, I get letters, and I'm always wrestling with this, and the one I just got 2 days ago that I wrote my reply yesterday, this young man had, he and his wife had triplets, and the triplets were born prematurely, and they're in intensive care for 6 months, and his family has quit speaking to him because everybody's so stressed about it. And he and his wife are about to break up. And God bless him, he wants to write a book about it. And I said, you need to write a blog. That's what you should do. Start with a blog. And you're not going to be able to do very much. I mean, you have no time. And he does. He's working a full-time job, helping with the three babies. I said, just get something down every day on this blog and try to build traffic, you know, and I know there's lots of ways to do that, and build some traffic, and you never know. If the right editor stumbles upon that, maybe good things will happen, and if not, at least after a year or two or five, you're going to have a lot of rough draft to work with. But it's always been tough. It's never been an easy road, but sure, it's different now, for sure.
I have two questions, and I came in late, so forgive me if it covered something already. But do you have, like, a work schedule? How much do you write a day? Like, do you have, like, a word count you try and hit every day or hours you put in?
Well, I treat it like a full-time job. You know, I was a carpenter for 5 years after college while I was getting started. So I'm kind of still on those hours, 8 to 4:30 with a half hour for lunch, right? Although Gail's getting me to take longer lunches, so we get a walk in at lunchtime. So I treat it like a job. I typically compose in the mornings before I turn on check email or turn on the internet or do anything that could distract me. What I love to do is get up in the morning, grab a cup of coffee, even before breakfast, just start composing because that gives you it going before you have time to start doubting your ability because it doesn't change. The blank page is still terrible no matter how many books you've written. So compose in the mornings, take a break at lunch, and then in the afternoons do rewriting or organization or research. And 4:30, 5, wrap it up and stop. I used to work 16-hour days, and that's stupid. I don't do that. It's good for a young person, kept me out of trouble, but it would not work for me now. I'd be exhausted the next day, so I pace myself. It was always surprising to me that probably on average, in a 40-hour work week, I probably average 10 good solid hours of full concentration composing at the most. There are weeks when it's a lot less than that. And the rest of the time is the rewriting, the polishing, That is far, far more time than actual composition. I tend to compose often in snatches of a, you know, a sentence or two or a paragraph. Great days, 5 pages. Those are the legendary days you never forget, but they're rare, you know.
Different type of question. I have a family on Sugar Island, past St. Mary's River.
Yeah.
And they've said for years the water level's been real low. They've lost their shoreline. And I was wondering if there's any, if you knew anything about that, because they, it's a topic of conversation whenever I see them.
Yeah. Well, there's natural highs and lows in the Great Lakes. Absolutely, we went through one of the lowest, you know, in a century just recently. Now it's come back up. It's come up faster than anybody expected. Yeah, really fast. And that's, who knows? The weather patterns are changing. One problem, of course, is that we have runoff now is faster, more full than ever because of so much pavement and because of changes in agriculture. You know, the agricultural plowing techniques have changed, allows water to run off a lot faster. So when we do have a year like last year with lots of rain, more of it runs off than permeates the soil. So they tell them they can expect ups and downs forever.
Any last questions?
Okay. Oh, here's one. Oh, okay.
Oh, two more. Okay, two great. More. And then we'll wrap it up.
Yeah.
Have you written any fiction?
I have. I continue to write fiction, short fiction. I've tried novels 3 times, and two of them have sputtered out at 60 pages, magically, right at 60. The third one has got some legs. That might go. And my work habit has been, instead of writing poetry in the mornings, I'm working on that novel for just an hour or so every morning when I first wake up, and then I turn to nonfiction. But I still love it. I have always loved short fiction and love writing it and reading it, of course, and I'll probably always do that. So maybe someday I'll completely turn over to nothing but fiction. So.
Kind of follow up on the writing technique. How much would you say you have preconceived in your head that just needs to get channeled onto the paper versus gets formulated while you are writing? And
That's an interesting question. I think more often than not, I don't know what I'm going to say until I'm writing it. More often than not, it'll, you know, it might be an image or even a feeling that I know there's something in there that needs to be expressed. And I don't know quite how it's going to happen, and that seems to be the way it is most often for me. As I'm writing, I'll go, wow, and that's really rewarding too. When you don't know what you're going to say and it comes out, that seems sort of magical. But it's not the same for every writer. Last year, I interviewed Jim Harrison, the novelist and poet and screenwriter and food writer and a genius and amazing writer. I think one of our great living writers. And I had always heard this about him, but I was able to ask him point blank. I said, how much of your fiction, your novels, he doesn't write short fiction, he writes novels and novellas. I said, how much of it do you have in your head before you put pen to paper? And he said, all of it. All of it. He knows exactly what he's going to do. He claims right from the beginning. He has it, and I kind of believe him because he talked about Legends of the Fall, his most famous novella, and how he wrote it in 3 weeks, 100 pages, and it's a masterpiece. It's one of the great pieces of fiction late 20th century, and he said, and I asked him, you know, how could that have happened? And he goes, I had been rehearsing that story in my head for years. He had it. He just carries it in his head, and he keeps imagining it. And he didn't say this, but I got the idea that he imagines things so deeply that they become real so that it's like he's writing a memory. He's writing a memoir, not fiction, because it seems so real to him. But I didn't ask him that.
Thank you very much for joining us, Jerry.
Well, thank you. Thank you.